Hello and welcome to The Wanderer, the Anglo-Saxon Heathen podcast. In this episode, we're going to look at a part of the legend of Robin Hood. I'd like to thank J.C. Holt, who wrote the Robin Hood book, the revised and enlarged edition, and I hope you enjoy this episode. The Legend of Robin Hood. Practically all that is known of the medieval legend of Robin Hood is derived from five surviving poems or ballads and a fragment of a play. The earliest of these, which describes itself as the Talking of the Monk and Robin Hood, and is conventionally known as Robin Hood and the Monk, is found in a manuscript collection written about 1450, in which the piece is included with a prayer against thieves and robbers, and a treatise on the seven deadly sins, in a very mixed bag of poetic and moralistic material. Another tale, entitled Robin Hood and the Potter, probably written shortly after 1503. These two stories are chance survivals. By this time, however, the legend was well enough known to attract the attention of the early printers. Between the last years of the 15th and the middle of the 16th century, there appeared no less than five editions of a lengthy poem describing the deeds of Robin Hood. Of these, one which supplies only half the text was possibly derived from an Antwerp press between 1510 and 1515. Another, which is complete, comes from the press of the famous English printer, Wynkyn de Worde, who worked between 1492 and 1534. Between them, these two provide a text which the one describes as a jest of Robin Hood and the other as a little jest of Robin Hood. The remaining three versions all later supplied the corrections or minor additions. These five printed versions were all derived directly or indirectly from a single written source. What it was is uncertain. Who wrote it is unknown. However, the balance of probability is that the jest was first composed in something very close to its present form, in the 15th century, perhaps even as early as 1400. Two other early tales were found in a manuscript which Thomas Percy, the Bishop of Dromore, Ireland, 1782 to 1811, rescued from destruction in a Shropshire house and used for his Reliques of Ancient English Poetry, published in 1765. The manuscript, which has become famous as the Percy Folio, was written in the middle of the 17th century, but it contains two stories which are certainly very much earlier. One, Robin Hood, his death, is closely related to the closing verses of the jest. Robin Hood and Guy of Gisborne is archaic in form and language and shares some of its subject matter with a play about Robin Hood, a fragment of which survives in a manuscript of 1475, which possibly belonged to the Paston family. The Percy Folio also contains a ballad called Robin Hood and the Curtal Friar. This is less archaic in style than Guy of Gisborne and, as it stands, can scarcely be counted with the other early tales. However, the dramatic fragment of 1475 mentions Friar Tuck as a member of Robin's company. So some story of Robin and a friar was in circulation in the 15th century. Stories of Robin were current long before these surviving pieces were composed. In a text of William Langland, Piers Plowman, written in about 1377, one of the characters, Sloth, is made to say, "I do not know my Paternoster perfectly as the priest sings it, but I know rhymes of Robin Hood and Randolph, Earl of Chester." This is the earliest literary reference to Robin. It implies that rhymes of Robin Hood were already widely disseminated in the last quarter of the 14th century. Indicates that the legend was known over a century earlier, in 1261-62. Hence, between the origin of the legend and the first surviving versions of circa 1450, there was an interval of over 200 years. The surviving stories can only be properly understood with this interval in mind. They spring not from the point of origin of the legend, but from different stages in its growth. They emphasise different aspects of Robin's activities. They introduce different characters. They reflect different geographical backgrounds. They may have been directed to different audiences. Diversification came easily. In every generation, performers and authors assess their audience afresh. and combine their own inventiveness and powers of expression with what came down to them as a literary tradition or by word of mouth. Composition and repetition were intermingled. Each tale contains both old and new components, old social assumptions and conventions which descend with the poetic material to mix with those of the author's own day. Hence, these robust, simple stories constitute singularly delicate and complex evidence about Robin, what he was thought to have been, and about the social context in which the telling of his deeds was born and nurtured. The Jest is a long poem of 456 four-line stanzas, divided into eight cantos. In number one, the scene is set in the outlaws' camps in Barnsdale, and the story opens abruptly. Robin will not dine until he has welcomed an unexpected guest to the feast. The knight accepts the invitation to dinner, which is lavish and which he much enjoys. At the end of the meal, Robin suggests that he should pay for it, and the sad condition of the knight is then made plain. "I have nothing in my coffers," said the knight, "which I would shame not to offer." His immediate resources indeed amount to a mere 10 shillings. On Little John verifying this, Robin seeks an explanation of his guest's anomalous poverty. And this opens up the main plot of these three stories. In order to go bail for his son, who has committed a homicide, the knight has had to sell his goods and mortgage his estates for £400 to the Abbot of St. Mary's in York. Robin decides to lend him the money, the repayment pledged on the name of the Virgin Mother, and with this advance and the provision of a suitable horse and raiment, the knight is sent on his way, accompanied by Little John as his servant. In the second story, the scene shifts to York, where the Abbot of St. Mary and his crony, the High Justice of England, await the coming of the knight, or rather sit relishing the final day for the payment of the debt, after which the knight's land will be forfeit. At length, the knight appears poorly dressed by a deliberate intent. There is much play on the abbot's lack of charity. "Tears on my arrival, rewarded you would have been." That spoils the abbot's day. The abbot sat still and ate no more for all his royal fare. He leaned his head on his shoulder and soon began to stare. His discomfort is complete. The justice will not even return the fee he received to take the abbot's side. The knight returns home in triumph. There he accumulates £400, and the story closes with him setting forth to Barnsdale to repay the debt to Robin. The fourth story at first duplicates the first. Once more, Little John, Much, and Will are sent out by Robin to find a guest for dinner. This time their guest is less willing. He is a monk who is only persuaded to come by force after his escort has been put to flight. At dinner, he is revealed as the highest cellarer of St. Mary's, and Robin and his men at once agree that, as a monk of St. Mary, he has been sent to repay the debt pledged in her name. "You told with your own tongue, and you may not deny, how you are her servant, and serve her every day. And you are made her messenger, my money to repay. Therefore I thank you all to the more that you have come on your appointed day." However, the cellarer, who earlier at York had revelled in the knight's impending default, now denies all knowledge of the debt, and, when questioned about his coffers, only admits to carrying a mere 20 marks. As with the knight, Robin asks Little John to open his baggage, and this time the result is different. The monk is carrying £800. The outlaws rejoice. The Virgin Mother has repaid the loan twofold. "I make my vow to God," said Robin. "Monk, what did I tell you? A lady is the truest woman that I have ever found." "By dear worthy God," said Robin, "I might search throughout all England and never find my pleasure a better security." The rueful monk is sent on his way to London without his £800. And to conclude the story, the knight returns to pay Robin's loan. Instead, Robin gives him the extra £400 acquired over and above the initial advance. And so all ends happily. Robin thus relieved the knight of all his care. God, who sits in heaven high, grant us well to fare. It will be noticed that in all this, Little John moves about in mercurial fashion. He is with the knight at York in story two, and once more with Robin in Barnsdale in story four. This is partly because a very different element is introduced into the poem in story three. Here, Little John takes part in an archery contest observed by the Sheriff of Nottingham. His archery is masterly. Three times Little John shot about, and always he slit the wand. The proud sheriff of Nottingham by the marks did stand. The sheriff swore an enormous oath by him that died on the cross. This man is the best archer that we have ever seen. The sheriff thereupon invites John into his service. Little John, under the alias of Reynold Greenleaf, accepts. He is determined to pay the sheriff out, although it is not clear for what. At this stage, the outlaw's inveterate hostility to the sheriff is taken for granted. In his new role, Little John soon quarrels with the cook while the sheriff is away hunting. They fight and the cook proves so doughty an adversary that John asks him to join Robin's band. This he agrees to do, and after helping themselves to the sheriff's valuables, the two of them join Robin in the forest. There Little John him bethought on a shrewd while and goes off in search of the sheriff. By the promise of good hunting, he lures him into the arms of Robin. The sheriff is compelled to sup from his own looted plate and to spend the night sleeping in outlaw fashion, in a green cloak under the greenwood tree. One night is enough for him. "Before I stay here another night," said the sheriff, "Robin, I now pray thee, I would rather you strike off my head this morning, and I will forgive it to thee." "Let me go then," said the sheriff, "for holy charity, and I will be the best friend that you've ever had." So in the morning he is released after swearing on Robin's sword never to harm Robin or do other than aid his men. Story 4 then completes the tale of the indebted knight and the monks of St. Mary's. Story 5 opens with yet another archery contest, arranged this time by the sheriff of Nottingham, who promises a gold and silver arrow for the victor. Robin and his men take part, and inevitably Robin wins. The human cry is then raised against them. They have been betrayed by the sheriff, and although they are able to hold off his posse, Little John is wounded in the knee, and the outlaws have to take refuge in the castle of Sir Richard at the Lee, who is identified with the knight of Story 1, 2 and 4. The knight welcomes them, the castle gates are shut, and they feast in safety. The sixth story opens with the castle under siege by the sheriff, but this is soon brought to an end. After an altercation with the knight, the sheriff goes off to London to appeal to the king. Robin and Little John reappears, only to find that they have eluded him, and he promptly takes revenge by waylaying and capturing the knight whilst he is out hawking. The knight's wife tells Robin, who musters his men, pews the sheriff of Nottingham, and kills him. Robin bent a very good bow, an arrow he drew at will. He so hit the proud sheriff that upon the ground he lay quite still. And before he could rise on his feet to stand, he struck off the sheriff's head with his bright blade. The outlaws drive off the sheriff's men and release the knight, who returns to the greenwood with them until Robin can obtain pardon for them from the king. In the seventh story, the king resolves the fate of the outlaws and their knightly ally. He comes to Nottingham with knights in great array in order to take that gentle knight and Robin Hood if he could. But he finds that he cannot deal with a knight by depriving him of his lands, for no one will accept a gift which might prove fatal with Robin Hood still at large. His temper is not softened by the state of his forest, which Robin has depleted of deer, and always went good Robin, both by hideout and by hill, and always slew the king's deer and dealt with them at his will. At length the king is persuaded to use guile. He enters the forests with a small company, all disguised as monks. The familiar scenes are then repeated. Robin waylays him and entertains him, believing him to be an abbot, sent by the king to invite the outlaws to Nottingham. After the usual feast, the outlaws held an archery contest with a clout on the head as a penalty for those who missed the target. Robin buffets his men with gusto, only to have to submit in the end to the abbot's chastisement. As his own shooting falters, the abbot's blow is wondrous lusty and he stands revealed as the king. The outlaws immediately submit. They are pardoned and enter the royal service. The eighth story opens with the king and the outlaws returning to Nottingham, all dressed in Lincoln green. The knight is restored to his land, but Robin, after a year or more in the king's service, begins to find life stale. All his men have left except him, Little John and Scathelock, and he has exhausted his wealth, the rich world of the court. Above all, he laments, "Once I was an archer good, stout and also strong. I was counted the best archer that there was in Merry England. Alas, then," said good Robin, "alas and well awoe. If I dwell longer with the king, sorrow will be the death of me. He obtains permission to visit a chapel, which he founded in Barnsdale. Once there, the scene is too tempting. Robin slew a very great hart. Then his horn he did blow. Then all the outlaws of that forest the horn might recognise. He is recruited with his band and lives in the greenwood for 22 years. In the end, he is slain by treachery. He visits his relative, the prioress of Kirklees, for medical treatment. She has a secret lover, Sir Roger of Doncaster, and the two of them plot the outlaw's death. The jest ends briefly in pathos, and with a pious prayer for Robin's soul. The jest is a long, rambling narrative. One critic has commented enthusiastically on the poem's remarkable unity, and above all its narrative symmetry, and concludes that it is the work of a skilled artist. This is only really applicable to the tale of Robin and the indebted knight in the first, second and fourth stories. This certainly is a well-integrated, nicely balanced piece. It is held together stylistically by the use of current scenes. Robin's refusal to dine without guests, the dispatch of his men in search of them, the ritual of the dinner, the request for payment, and the opening of the guests' money bags, and so on. This is emphasised by verbal repetition. Compare, for example, the discovery of the knight's resources with that of the monks in story 1 and 4, first the knights. Little John spread his mantle down, very fair upon the ground, and there he found in the knight's coffer no more than half a pound. Little John led it lie quiet, still and humbly sought his master. What tidings, John, said Robin, sir, the knight is true enough. Little John spread his mantle down, as he had done before, and counted out the monk's bag 800 pounds and more. Little John let it lie quite still, and went to his master in haste. Sir, said he, the monk is true enough, our lady has doubled your throw. Such repetitions reinforce the moral lesson of the story. The knight tells the truth, and Robin helps him. The monk lies, for it is only in repaying a debt pledged on the virgin that the monk is true, and Robin robs him. The contrast lies not simply in truthfulness, but in the courtesy of Robin and the knight on the one hand, and in the discourtesy and churlishness of the abbot and the monks on the other. It is underlined by a unifying religious theme. Robin is devoted to the Virgin Mother, and it is in her name that his loan to the knight is pledged. The knight's debt is to the abbot of St. Mary's, and it is through a monk of her abbey St. Mary returns Robin's loan with interest. New material was introduced into the tale in at least two stages. The second story ends with the knight riding out to repay Robin, his company well decked, bearing gifts of bows and arrows for the victor, for the outlaws. He then tarries at a wrestling match, where he rescues the victor, stranger yeoman in danger from the home crowd. This is used as a device to delay his return to Robin, but it is not essential to the main plot since he has already dwelled fair at home before setting out. That it was an integral part of the original story is unlikely. Much more obvious intrusive is the tale of Little John in the third story. Here, the plot is wrenched into an entirely new context in the first three stanzas. Give ear and listen, gentlemen, all of who now are here, of Little John that was the knight's man. Good mirth you shall hear. It was upon a merry day when young men would go to shoot. Little John forthwith fetched his bow and said he would with them meet. The return to the theme of the knight and his debt is achieved most equally artificially at the beginning of story 4. The sheriff stayed in Nottingham. He was glad he had escaped, and Robin and his merry men went to the wood forthwith. Let's go to dinner, said Little John. Robin Hood said nay, for I fear our lady is angry with me, for she has not sent me my pay. That tale is nicely rounded off, and yet another abrupt shift is made to revert to the sheriff in story 5. Now the knight has taken his leave and departed on his way. Robin Hood and his merry men stayed quiet for many a day. Give ear and listen, gentlemen, and hark to what I shall say. How the proud sheriff of Nottingham proclaimed a splendid game, that all the best archers of the month should come in a certain day, and he who would show the best of all would bear the prize away. Thereafter, the narrative moves more easily through the quarrel with the sheriff to the arrival of the king and the subsequent denouement. These contrived linking passages suggest very strongly that the jest contains not one, but at least two stories or groups of stories. First, the tale of the knight, the outlaws and the monks of St. Mary's, and second, the more miscellaneous material about the sheriff and the king. They differ not only in subject matter, but also in geographic setting, for the first is based in Barnsdale, and the second in Sherwood and Nottingham. Some attempts was made to give the whole work unity. The tale of Little John and the sheriff is inserted into the middle of the story of the indebted knight, rather than crudely tacked on the end. Sir Richard at the Lee of Story 5 is carefully, if somewhat unconvincingly, identified with the indebted knight of Stories 1, 2 and 4. The author brought sufficient sophistication to his task for it to be difficult to distinguish between those unifying elements which he himself contributed and those derived from the similarities of situation, theme and versification already present in the material he used. Yet he was still unable to produce a work in which the component elements were fully amalgamated. The second story of the outlaws and the sheriff is plainly less well constructed than the first concerning the knight and his debt. The tale of Little John in Story 3 duplicates, in less precise fashion, the sheriff's archery contest in Story 5. Story 3 adds little to the whole plot except to place the sheriff under an oath of friendship, which he treacherously breaks in Story 5. The continuity here is merely formal. The sheriff of Story 5 is menacing and villainous. The sheriff of Story 3 is a laughing stock. In much of this, critics have differed and will continue to differ about the extent of the unifying contribution of the author of the jest, or about the number of distinct component elements which went into its making. There is room for argument, if only because none of the components survived other than the jest. Of all the early tales, only one, Robin Hood, his death, comes close enough to the jest to suggest direct interdependence. Each of the others embodies a distinct and independent tradition of its own.